Welcome to Mysterious Topics, a podcast focusing on intriguing topics deserving further scrutiny. Each episode, the hosts examine a topic, add their opinions, and hopefully pique your interest as well. Visit MysteriousTopics.com for contact information and more. Now, here are your hosts, Chuck and John.
Hi, Chuck.
Well, hello, John. It's sure good to talk to you again. It's been quite a while.
Yes, it has. It's great to talk to you again. And I guess for our listeners, they're thinking, well, it was only last November the last time we talked, and we actually just recently published another recording that we did. But we haven't actually done a podcast together since June of 2016, and it is now March of 2017.
So that's 9 months ago.
Yes, and I'm sure everybody is aware, because they would have had to download this podcast, they can see the title, which is the final Mysterious Topics podcast, and I wanted to have the podcast go out the way it came in with both of us here, and you graciously agreed to come back and talk with me one final time, so that's what we're doing here.
Great.
First of all, I think our listeners would like to hear what you've been up to for the last, 8 or 9 months?
Well, sure. I am not doing anything really spectacular. John, you know, I've told you many times that I really enjoyed my employment. I worked many years, you and I did together, and you're still active in your employment. And I hated to retire because I enjoyed it so much. But the reason, one of the main reasons I retired was because even though I enjoyed it, I wanted to be able to do some things that I wasn't able to do because of time constraints working so much. And so that's why I did retire. And you and I got involved in this podcast, and it takes a lot of time. In fact, John, I don't know how you have found the time to spend what you do on a podcast, working full-time with a family, and then to do all the work related to the podcast and to do it well, especially now you're doing it, you have been doing it with the interviews and doing a very good job. I think you are a much better time manager than I am to be able to do those kind of things. I just don't have that same ability that you do. But anyway, getting back to what I've been doing, it's mostly family things, things that I can't do or I couldn't do while I was working. My wife does, my wife Mary, she travels somewhat in her job, and I'm now able to go with her in many instances in that job. And also I've been doing things with grandkids, and of course I've got my bike and my kayak, and I do my cross-country skiing and my snowshoeing and that kind of thing, and the gardening and the bird watching and all those things I enjoy. And John, I've also started reading. I really have gotten away from a computer, which is kind of unusual. Most people are more into computers now. I've been reading physical books, the old books that I probably should have read when I was in high school, things like Jane Eyre and other classics. And people may laugh at me for doing that, but I'm actually enjoying it. So that's pretty much what I've been doing. Nothing really special.
I remember you telling me when, after you had been retired for, I don't know, probably less than a year, how you said that it didn't take very long until all of a sudden it felt like you had too many things to do, even though you, like you said, when you retire, you have freed up all your time, and all of a sudden all your time is taken up again.
People that might say that they get bored when they're retired, they just aren't looking, because you can obviously, if you want to, keep very busy doing interesting things.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, you know very well how much time it takes to podcast. And when you decided to step away, I know you and Jordan Bonaparte, too, from the Nighttime Podcast, who we were working on the Curse of Oak Island recap series with at the time, I had gone back and forth over the months, because you told me plenty of time before that you were going to step away. I went back and forth over those months. Am I going to keep it up? Am I not? And the reason it came down to the way it is, where this will be the final one, is because I did make a commitment to Jordan that we would cover the season 4 Curse of Oak Island series again. So I thought, well, I have to keep the podcast going through at least then. And I, at the time, I was trying to decide what I was going to do. And I thought it would be really good to speak with some of our listeners. And so that's how that came about. We had several guest hosts, and I thought all those episodes were really good. I mean, you know, really, really good. I thought everybody did a great job.
I agree.
And I just want to list those people now just to give them recognition again. They're doing such a great job. We had Ryan Clark from Ohio, who I talked to him about the Waverly Hills Sanatorium and also Bobby Mackey's Haunted Music World.
Right.
And, of course, Charlotte Lily Anderson from Brisbane, Australia. She's only 14 years old, and she did an excellent job on the Westall UFO incident and the Winchester Mystery Mansion.
I could not believe she was only 14. She was an excellent guest. She spoke very clearly and knowledgeable about what you guys were talking about. It was amazing.
Yeah, I agree. I think she definitely has a future if she ever decides to have her own podcast. And I know she said that she was interested in doing work in these types of mysterious topics in the future.
Yeah.
And also, of course, Phil Parslow, I talked to him about his Bigfoot infatuation.
Right.
Sean Fox, of course, from St. Albert, Canada. He's very knowledgeable in a lot of history topics. Pompeii and Herculaneum was really fun to talk with him about. And we also talked about the First Crusade, and then just recently, last week, the history of early Christianity.
When you two are talking together, it's like two knowledgeable historians talking about a topic. He obviously has a huge background in many historical topics, and you do too. And if you don't, you find a way to bring yourself up to speed on the topics. And if anybody wants to learn anything about history, just listen to you and Sean talk together. And also Sean, of course, he has been a moral supporter, writing us emails over the months and telling us, you know, how he enjoyed the podcast and so forth. So we always appreciated that.
Yeah, just based on his lengthy emails we got before I even spoke to him, I knew he would be an excellent guest on some of those topics. And that turned out to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, he's a whole lot more knowledgeable than I am. I, as you said, I kind of try to bone up on it as much as I can before that. But anyway, he's a great person to speak to about some of these history topics.
And one thing, John, that's what you and these interviews have done in a very positive way. You have always become very knowledgeable about the topic you're going to be talking about with the guests. And it really shows in the interviews because you're well prepared and comes across nicely in the podcast.
Oh, thanks. And also, of course, Sarah Patterson, my wife, we talked with about shark tracking, and we also read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. That was the one that came out on Christmas.
I think I told you about how I enjoyed that reading of The Night Before Christmas with you and Sarah. And it was really nice how you both did it perfectly in unison. I know maybe it didn't come out that way at first, but it really sounded well.
Yeah, it definitely didn't.
In fact, John, I think if you ever decide to continue in the podcast, which I hope you do, I think you and Sarah would be good co-hosts occasionally. I think you two interact well on the podcast. And while I'm on it talking about hoping you do continue, that was probably the fact that the podcast, that I was leaving the podcast, was probably the most difficult part, because I knew you were deeply involved in the podcast and you wanted to continue, I think, even though it did take a lot of time. And that was my most difficult part about leaving the podcast. There were a lot of other reasons why I didn't necessarily want to leave, but that was the most difficult part about leaving and why I wrestled with the decision to leave or not.
Yeah, well, I will talk about my decision in just a minute. I just want to get through the rest of these people to thank. And the next one is Nancy Kozoil from Vermont. We talked about Vermont spooky places, and she also emailed us several times.
Yeah, she has a good radio voice. She comes across very nice and loud and clear, and she's knowledgeable also.
Yeah, I agree. She sounds very good, and she's a writer, so maybe she should think about doing something in the podcast area. And Zach Kitka from Pennsylvania. Now, we had talked to him about the abandoned asylum in around the Pittsburgh area. I can't remember the name of it right now, but I talked with Zach. He was the guest host of the Ancient Flood Stories. And also Lisa Franz, we talked about the Stardust Ranch in Arizona, and she lives very near there. And of course, Jordan Bonaparte, Halifax, Nova Scotia, who we worked together with, both Chuck and I, on the Curse of Oak Island series recaps for over the last couple of years.
Yes, Jordan was also an early supporter. He obviously found our podcast because of the Oak Island podcast, which was our very first podcast. And he would communicate with us very often, in addition to the podcast that we did with him and that you continued to do after I left. And he was always an enjoyable person to talk to, and we definitely appreciate him. And I hope his nighttime podcast becomes very successful, because he's very good at it.
Yes, he is. And I think we both consider him a friend now, even though we haven't met him personally yet. We'll have to rectify that.
I think you're going to get up there pretty soon, sooner than later, in the Oak Island area.
And I'd also like to say that any of these co-hosts, that if they ever decide to start a podcast, please email me or message me on the Mysterious Topics Facebook page, and we'll let our people know about that on the Facebook page. Because I know a couple of them at least mentioned that they were considering starting their own podcast.
And they should, if they want to, that's for sure.
Yes, every one of them was great. And I just want to also thank the guest that I talked with on my show, Angela Hutchian, who was the Rh negative person with abilities. That was my very first interview that I did after Chuck left.
Mm-hmm.
And then also Cliff Dunning from the Earth Ancients podcast, who I had an enjoyable conversation with about a variety of topics. And his podcast is still going strong. People should check that out if they'd like to hear some of similar stories or similar topics. And then, of course, also my most recent one, where I talked with William and Susan Buhlman, who co-authored the book Higher Self Now, and who we also talked about in our OBE episode, which Chuck and I actually recorded last June, but I didn't release until just recently. And mainly because we did talk and read a little bit in a couple of William Buhlman's previous books. And I wanted to get permission from him to release that before we did. And also, you know, I was hoping I'd be able to talk with him, and they were very, very gracious in talking with me about that. And I really appreciate that.
John, I wanted to make a few comments about that interview that you had with William and Susan.
Okay.
I think when I finished listening to that podcast, I felt like I believe that William Buhlman probably thought that that was the best interview he ever had. I don't know. I can't really speak for him, but I felt that is what he probably felt, and maybe Susan also. And there's probably maybe two, maybe three reasons why I feel that way. First of all, like I mentioned earlier, you in interviews, you are very well prepared, which you were. And secondly, I think that you had this intense interest. I know you have this intense interest in the OBE topic, and that makes it much more enjoyable. And thirdly, I think you read every one of his books, if not, maybe not everyone, but if not, almost everyone. So you were totally prepared. You were very enthusiastic about the topic, and you read his information. So what more could someone being interviewed ask of an interviewer? And I doubt if any of his interviewers had so much of a similar background as you in that regard.
Well, first of all, thanks for saying that, Chuck. I appreciate that. I have read every single one of his books and more. I've read some over again, and I have many of his CDs, if not all of them. So, I know his work very well. And not only that, because I told this story, so I don't necessarily have to go all over this, but when I first heard him interviewed the first time, and when he was talking about that, I realized this is what I was experiencing. And then when I started reading his material, it wasn't just that I was learning about it for the first time. It was almost as if that, yes, this is what I have felt all along. It's almost like I knew this before. I was just being reminded of it at that time. So it's very much a part of me. It's just, I know it to be true, at least to me. So it was very important to me. And this is a person, I told you this before, if people would come up to me and say that, that's why I had that question at the end for them about if you could talk to anyone in history, who would it be? The reason is because if somebody came up to me and they have, and I've told them this, that the first name that comes to my mind is William Buhlman. And everybody always says, well, who is that? They never heard of him. So, So that's why I wanted to have this interview. But if I were just talking with him for myself, I would have had, well, first of all, I would have had a lot more questions and they would have been slightly different, but I wanted to ask the questions I did because I wanted people that maybe have not heard him before to understand his material a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that was the purpose of that.
And you incorporated Susan Buhlman's work with hospice into the discussion very well also.
Yeah, and I just think that for anybody that's in that line of work anywhere, they're special people because it can't be easy. And as we talked about during that interview, how just people coming in to visit somebody who is on the last stages of their life are always very uncomfortable, or they don't know how to act. And so I think that book is very important just for that reason alone, to understand how you should react to that. And, I just think that's really important. And like I said, the people doing that should really be commended.
They should be commended. And I agree how difficult and challenging it would be to do something like that. Yet at the same time, if you're capable of doing that, if one is capable of doing that, it would be very rewarding. Just think, being able to share in something as personal and special as someone's death, that's really a privilege, I believe.
And the reason I think people are so uncomfortable about it is just for the fact that they're just not sure what's going on, what's going to happen at that time. So people feel uncomfortable. But if you know what's going to happen, then it's a lot easier to, first of all, to not show, to not be totally grieving at that time, but to know that they're moving on. That's why I think this information that William Buhlmann is expressing in all of his work, and as well now Susan Buhlmann with hers, is really important for people to understand, especially people that may not have any beliefs about any kind of an afterlife. Because if you can not just have a belief in the afterlife, but know that it exists, that would completely change people in this regard. And that's why I think William Buhlmann and other people that are doing this OBE research, and there are others, the Monroe Institute, where he is now conducting his workshops, you know, that's what they're dedicated to. And I think these people are, you know, every bit as courageous, if not more, than all the great explorers in history, like Magellan and Marco Polo. And we talked about Zheng He, who was a Chinese explorer back in the late 14th century, early 15th century.
Mm-hmm.
But they're traveling all over the world, not knowing what they're going to run into. And when you do this, you're traveling into other worlds, not knowing what you're getting into. And basically, William's work is giving anyone else the instruction manual so that you will be able to do it without any problems.
Right. And we talk about people's reluctance or fear associated with hospice. I think once one considers entering the hospice program, it's almost like a commitment. Because I think, isn't it, if the hospice program deals with people within the last 6 months, supposedly, of their expected life, and when you join that program, it's like, okay, here it goes. Now that I'm in hospice, this is it. I'm going to go downhill. But I think once they get into it and realize the many benefits of being associated with someone that works with hospice people, is very positive.
Yeah, I agree. And so, anyway, back to my reasons for stopping the podcast at this point. As Chuck said, when he stepped away, I had to cut the show down to just once a week, and that was still, with just one person doing that work, it was basically the same amount of work as before. So I kind of knew right away when I was doing this that once the Curse of Oak Island recap series was over, I was going to stop, just because of the time element involved. There's just a lot of time involved in it, and it was mainly because the whole reason we started the podcast was our conversations and our interactions together. And when half of that is missing, it's not the same podcast. Even though the guest hosts were terrific and everything, it just, we didn't have the same, you know, chemistry having known each other for so long. That's really a key in it. So it's just not the same. And to continue it as something else, you know, I just didn't want to do that. And really, I decided, especially after talking with William and Susan, that I wanted to do some more research in just a few topics without having to produce the information on a weekly basis. That takes up so much time. There's really no time for anything else. And so this way I can focus on doing that research when I can fit it in, as opposed to having to fit it in to get something up and ready each and every week. And of course, it'll be good to just free the time up so I have more time for personal things. And as I said, I can work on some of the research that I want to work on just a few of these topics when I have the time. And of course, one of those would be the OBE phenomenon, and that will require, in order to actually work on it, some regular time. Not nearly as much as I've been putting in with the podcast, but just a little bit of it. And also, one of the other things on the top of that list would be something that Chuck and I talked about a lot before, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, but I think that there needs to be some sort of unified field theory of between spiritualism and science pertaining to consciousness. And we'll talk a little bit about this towards the end, but that's my reasoning for discontinuing the podcast at this time.
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I do hope that you do, or you are able to continue in some form in the future. I really think you will, but like you said, it just takes so much time. I know many of our podcasts that we did turned out very well, but there were some of the podcasts that were not as good as others, is not as good as what I would have liked them to be. And part of that is you just can't do a podcast total justice by only studying it for a short time. In order to do it properly, you need to immerse oneself in the topic, and that's not easy to do, especially when we were doing two a week.
Yeah, but when there were both of us here where we could kind of get away with it, I don't want to say getting away with it, but I think it actually worked out to a positive, to a benefit, when usually one of us would do that particular topic and work hard on it and get it ready, and then the other one would go over it. Well, but because the other one was working on another topic. So then when we were getting ready to record, the other person who hadn't prepared it would go over it. But then when we recorded, because one person knew quite a bit more about it, the other person would, while we were talking about it, would say, oh, I didn't know that. And they'd ask that question. And it was like, a lot of people said, it was like we were all learning together. It was because one of us, as I said, knew it pretty well, and the other person, because they were working on one of the other topics, was just going over it a few days before, checking it out, seeing what was there, and I think it actually worked out well that way. But of course, doing this kind of thing on your own, you have to know everything about every topic, and that's why I said the time involved in doing the podcast on my own was just a little bit too much.
I agree with what you said about when we were both doing the podcast, where one of us knew very little about the topic on a particular day. I think it might have come across as being unprepared on one person's part, but it was intentional. Like you said, I think it comes across better in a conversational way if one person is not that familiar with the topic and can ask questions of the person that was more familiar. So I agree. I think it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it was intentional after a while. It wasn't intentional at first. Right. It just worked out that way. But then we realized, hey, this really is kind of a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Well, so we're gonna talk about basically some of the updates to some of our topics from over the past couple of years. But just, I wanted to mention one thing. This is a really important sentence that William Buhlmann has in more than one of his books, but it is the statement that we alone are responsible for our reality in every dimension we experience. We must purge false identity, beliefs, and fears. And so when you think about that, when we're the ones that creating our reality in every dimension, and I mean, you could give many, many examples of this, but I just, for some reason, I thought about the one podcast we did, and I know we kind of had a little chuckle about it when we were doing it, was the Icelandic Elves podcast, where 54.4% of Icelanders believe in elves, and many of them say they have seen those elves. And I was just thinking, so there's something known, William talks about in his books, a collective conscious in, for instance, the astral dimension or whatever, where people are. And this goes back to one of our other favorite topics, the TV series Lost, where they had created this other reality where everything was going good for the characters. It was the double timeline, I think, in the last year. Chuck, remember that?
I do.
Yes. And so here, these people in Iceland, you got over half of the people believing it. So they're sure that they exist. It's almost like they're creating them, so maybe they do exist.
I often wonder about that topic. When we did that podcast, I thought maybe it was because of the long winter nights where it was dark almost all the time, or I just was trying to figure out what was going on. Maybe what you're talking about today is what really happened. I don't know. It's funny when we talk. It was funny when we talked about it, but maybe there is something there.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there is. I know, even though we were chuckling about it, I think both of us still felt that it wasn't something to just completely dismiss. Mm. But it's still kind of hard for anyone from somewhere else to actually believe that too, necessarily. But if you're going to approach things with an open mind, you have to at least consider that. And this is just one area where I just felt, well, this could be a little piece of evidence that may actually point to that being true.
Right.
And so over all of our podcasts, we've always steered clear of politics and religion as much as we can. But I know recently, talking with our resident history person, Sean Fox, I have delved into that area where we've been talking about the history of early Christianity. And I just wanted to mention that while I was editing that latest episode, I sort of had an epiphany about the Apostle books and how they may have been a reaction to each other, because they were written by someone who was saying that they were one of the under the name of one of the apostles, but it's almost certain that none of them could have been written by the apostle, but it was this person who maybe was following the beliefs of that apostle and decided he should write the story as he saw it for that apostle. And so I just thought, once one of those was written and it started getting around, then somebody else who was following the beliefs of one of the other apostles was telling the story separately. It's almost like one of those TV shows where they show an event that happened from the perspective of everybody in there, maybe like four different people that had an experience, and how different it was from the perspective of the different person.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was just thinking that they wanted to present who they felt had the right events, and they wanted to put the person's name on it that would give it the most sway. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. And also, so when we started the podcast, we put the tag open-minded scrutiny on it. And the reason is because we want it to be open-minded. But just by putting that out there, it really made me double check myself every time we were doing a podcast to make sure we weren't just closing our mind off to something. And I really wanted to give every story the benefit of the doubt for as much as I could. And I was just wondering, Chuck, through the 2 years of doing our podcast, was there any particular topic that you found very hard to keep an open mind about?
Well, I really tried to keep an open mind about everything. I know we've done many podcasts or several podcasts about time travel. And as hard as I try to convince myself that it's real, I keep going back to the thought, how can this be? And even now, I want to think it's possible, and I want to tell myself, keep an open mind, but how can we travel back in time? And yet, having said that, who knows? I mean, I was just thinking about some of the things. Just this morning, I was thinking about some things in life that seem impossible. Just the birthing process of you and me and everybody else that's alive today were once inside their mother's womb and growing and surviving and coming out. And if somebody told me this today and I had never been experiencing that before in my life, I would have thought, there is no way, you know. So because of that, and because of many other things that go on, like even telecommunications that 100 years ago we never would have considered, cell phones and the like, I think anything is possible. Even though I may have a hard time having an open mind about time travel, that's probably the one that I that I do have a difficult time with.
Well, that's interesting because I don't have a difficult time with time travel element at all. Although going back in time apparently would present a whole lot more problems. But if you consider that on these other dimensions, whether you want to call it heaven or another dimension, astral or whatever, where supposedly time doesn't exist, supposedly time is a human invention and it really doesn't exist, then therefore I would think if certainly in this physical dimension where we have created time, it would make it impossible. However, if you're not in this particular dimension, then it becomes very easy, I would think, because time is all happening at once. There is no time. So therefore, you can go wherever you want at that point, I would think. So I think I can remain very open-minded about the possibilities of that. There are other topics where actually one that we have never done where I just couldn't consider the possibility because the evidence involved in that is, and Chuck, we had people email us this fairly early on that they wanted us to do a episode on the flat earth theory. And I think we both looked into it back then, and I've looked into it fairly significantly, and I just couldn't think that was a possibility.
Yeah, in thinking about that today, I try to put myself in the position of someone that lived a long time ago and who grew up thinking or believing or being told that the earth is flat and that if you go too far, you're going to fall off of it, the edge of it. I can imagine people actually believing that at the time. But now, of course, we can actually see the shape of Earth from outer space. And so we know it's not flat. But
yeah, but yet the people that believe in the flat Earth, or at least say they do, say that we don't have any evidence that all those things were faked. And that's their way around it. But you're right. It's pretty obvious. So even if you don't consider all the, the evidence of pictures of Earth from the moon that astronauts took and others, just simply looking out at space with telescopes and seeing everything else, now they're going to say all this is faked by NASA. But, so everything you say that is evidence, when you fly really high, there is a curvature. It's slight, but it's there. And just many other, you can go on YouTube and you can pull up people that have YouTube videos showing, proof that the Earth is not flat. But anyway, I don't want to get into this now. I just wanted to mention that's one that I have a really hard time. Also, one other one that I don't want to get into again, too, is a lot of people thinking that the Earth is only, 6,000 or 7,000 years old.
Yeah. And yet some people truly believe that. And if they believe that, that's up to them. And
right.
You're right. I don't want to get into the debate over that either. It's just something very personal to these individuals.
And very ironically, the first topic we're going to talk about as an update to one of our previous episodes is from February 27th of this year by Trevor Nance. And it's from Forbes.com. The title is 50,000-year-old super life discovered, says the head of NASA astrobiology. So right there, the 50,000-year-old super life on a globe that may only be 7,000 years old. Well, I think this might be proof there. I'm sure that people that believe in something to the idea that it's 7,000 years old only would say that this is NASA again faking stuff. But anyway, so we did this story on the Nika caves, the crystal caves.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, surreal looking crystals. Yes.
Extraordinary. And this, as we said, just came out less than a month ago. about them finding ancient life forms that have been trapped within the crystals for 50,000 years. The microbes have existed entirely on heavy minerals such as iron and manganese to create energy. They have adapted to one of the most hostile environments on Earth, evidence that life finds a way to cope in extreme conditions. Now, when we talked about this, Chuck, remember how they had to go through this elaborate, they had to put suits on because it was very hot down there. In this story, it says that it reaches up to 136 degrees Fahrenheit, and it's 99% humidity in there.
Just imagine, 136 degrees. If you put your finger in that temperature of water, you'd have to pull it away immediately. It would be so scorchingly hot.
Yeah. And these crystals are huge. Some of them up to 39 feet long and 13 feet in diameter. Weighing up to 55 tons per crystal. These are enormous crystals, and they are, it's really beautiful pictures of them, but it's interesting that they're still apparently down there. I know they were going to eventually let the caves flood in again, but apparently they're still investigating, and they're finding this, what they're calling a super life in the crystals.
When they let the caves flood, it helps to preserve everything that's inside of it, right? Is that why they want to flood them again?
Yeah, I don't think they want to disturb them, but also I think that it's costing a lot of money to keep them pumped out so that they can keep doing their research, and eventually they're going to find out whatever they can, and there probably will not be a need to keep them, to keep going in there, I guess. It's, you know, it's probably pretty expensive, just like a mine, any mine would be, to keep pumping out constantly.
Right.
And while we're down in Mexico, I have this other story about the Mexican government revealing Mayan documents proving extraterrestrial contact. Now, this is a story that I recently heard about, and we have links to all these stories, by the way, we'll have on our show notes to our podcast at our website, mysterioustopics.com, and you can click on and look at some of the images of what they found in caves and an area of Mexico, and they're just really interesting. You have to look at them. The ones we're looking at now have kind of a disc-shaped piece of pottery with very good drawings. I mean, they look like, it looks like a spaceship or a flying saucer type thing is landing.
Yeah,
and I hadn't heard about these until just recently, so I don't know a lot about them, but apparently there is a documentary that's going to be coming out on this, and, you know, something to keep your eye out on.
When we're looking at this, it reminds me somewhat of one of our podcasts that we did on Pumapunka, where we talked about maybe they were visited by extraterrestrials. And in that podcast, I know we mentioned specifically that many civilizations probably or possibly have risen and fallen over the years. In other words, back in many years ago, the civilization might have been more advanced and maybe with the aid of extraterrestrials. And then for whatever reason, that civilization had fallen over the years or maybe suddenly and disappeared, except for some of these artifacts that were left behind. We talked about at Pumapunka, where was that, in Bolivia, I think? I'm pretty sure it was, but it was a temple complex down there someplace. And well, anyway, it just, when you were talking now about this, these Mayan discs that you just mentioned, it reminded me of those cut blocks of stone that were so precisely cut that could only have been done with tools or implements that we really wouldn't expect to be existing back then.
Yes, and you're right. It is in Western Bolivia. I think it's pretty near the border with possibly, I think, Peru, but I'm not sure. But I was going to mention also, we had talked about, I don't know if we did a podcast on it or if it was in another topic, about a UFO incident that happened in northern Mexico. I think it was Socorro, maybe.
Okay.
Do you remember that where they were following a UFO, I think across the lower United States, and they followed it into Mexico and possibly got shot down or crashed or something like that.
Yes, I remember that. It was near Texas, I think.
Yes, it was northern Mexico, but it was in Mexico, and that was a big kind of incident between the Mexican authorities and the U.S. authorities. And well, anyway, you know, many people have speculated that the Mayans, obviously, they were very advanced. They had, although most of their books were destroyed by the Spaniards, unfortunately. They obviously were very advanced, just looking at their buildings and that. And I don't know, I think people are speculating that these Mayans, because these discs were made by the Mayans, by the way. They're not made by extraterrestrials. They're made by the Mayans, depicting that they may have possibly had interaction with people that were flying in ships. That doesn't necessarily mean they were coming from outer space or something, but there's something going on here. And this very well maybe how the Mayans became so sophisticated.
Yeah.
Maybe they were given a lot of information. Okay, so here's a story that I found that, well, we hadn't talked about this at all, but I just wondered, because it's near us, Chuck, if you have ever heard of this. They're called the Devil's Kettle Waterfall in Minnesota. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I read about it now since you sent me this link, but I really had never heard of about it before that.
Yeah, so, well, apparently it's a double, there's a couple different waterfalls, and they're trying to ascertain where the water's going, because they felt like it was just disappearing, a lot of the water. And I don't know how big of a mystery this story is. I think they thought it was a mystery. They were wondering what happened to the flowing water and where does it exit to the surface. And you can see in the picture where there's these two waterfalls and one supposedly water just disappearing, but they say they are running tests to measure the amount of water above the fall and then below the fall. And well, they haven't even done it yet. This is kind of a strange story, but they think it's going to show that all the water is just kind of going, there's a pathway through the rock and it's coming out where the other waterfall next to it is coming out. But
well, it has to go someplace. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
It is interesting.
It's interesting. I just don't know that they're making it out to be the big mystery that it is. Even if it isn't going into that river, as you said, it could be going way, way down through some sort of old tunnel or some old opening of some sort. And it may be filling or going into the river downstream a mile or something. Who knows?
Right.
This next story is about a Mars magnetic shield, and I found this really intriguing. That I found this on yahoo.com, and it's talking about NASA considering magnetic shield to help Mars grow its atmosphere. It's by Jay Bennett from Popular Mechanics of March 2nd of 2017, this year. And I find this really fascinating that they can... Basically, what they say they can do is put a couple of big magnets out into an area in space and put it there, and it will shield the sun's, you know, all the bad rays that our atmosphere does naturally for us now, which, since Mars lost its magnetosphere, it's completely susceptible to these rays. They put this magnet out, and the magnets, I think there's two of them, would create basically the same magnetosphere shield, and it would shield Mars and therefore allowing it to grow its atmosphere again. What I'm thinking about this story, Chuck, is that, well, yeah, that's all great that it would possibly do that for Earth, for Mars, but wouldn't it be even better to have that thing up there, or to have it available that we could move it into place anytime we thought there was going to be a coronal mass ejection, which could possibly wipe out all of our electronics here on Earth? Could we put that and out there and do the same thing for Earth. Instead of insulating all of our stuff here on Earth, we could just put something like that out into space.
Well, obviously, I'm not an expert in this. I don't know if it would work, but if that would be possible, I think it would be, it would make sense. As far as what they're, this project in altering Mars' atmosphere, I don't know. Do we really want to do that? What are there some unknown consequences that might result when we're messing with the atmosphere, basically, or the surrounding area of Mars, areas of Mars? I don't know.
I think what it would do is make, and I don't know how long it would take. It may take a long, long time, but it would allow the atmosphere to slowly start building up. And then what would happen is that the ice on the poles and other areas would start to melt and would create water. And of course, water is one of the essential ingredients for life as we know it anyway. And so I think it would just slowly start the process, making it slightly more habitable for us to send people there, maybe. I don't know.
This would make for a good science fiction movie to do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But getting back to your point, though, about protecting Earth from a sudden solar flare of sorts, I think if that was possible, that would really make sense.
Yeah, because we talked about that in our pole shift. I think we did a mini topic on that, at least, about the magnetic pole shift.
Right.
And what a possible disaster that could be, you know, depending on if it was actual a physical one where the whole crust of the Earth flips around, or if it's just a, more than likely it would just be the magnetic poles shifting around. And we have a story linked to what that would be like. And there's an image there of what the magnetosphere would kind of be all kind of wound up around itself instead of seamlessly going from the south to the north. And so anyway, I was just thinking if that happened, and this story saying, I think the title was something about that it could be about, it says that why the Earth's magnetic poles could be about to swap places and how it would affect us. So they're making it again sound like it could happen any day now. But basically they say again, well, it's bound to happen sometime in the next 2,000 years. So it probably won't happen anytime soon, but if we can get to the level of sophistication where we're able to start working on our space program and we're able to take a couple of big magnets and put them up in space somewhere where it would block that, I think it's probably a good idea if they go ahead with that for Mars. And then if we ever need to, we could fly one into place then, at least temporarily, because the pole shift, it said the last one lasted, I don't know, 250 years or something like that. So if that were to happen, it might be good to have that thing up there for a couple hundred years to just protect the planet Earth while that shift was messed up.
Yeah, that makes sense. And even going beyond the shift, these intense solar flares, I really think, and I think many scientists believe, that it's a real threat, not just 100 years from now, but probably any time where we get some severe or strong solar flare that could wipe out, at least temporarily, our communication system on Earth. And it would be devastating. It would just throw our whole economic system into chaos. And I think that's a real possibility sometime not too far in the future.
Yeah, I agree. And the next couple topics, actually two into one, are in regards to our Lemuria podcast. And just recently, there have been stories about the fact that they discovered a continent, which they're calling Zealandia, which is right around just in the ocean. It's covered mainly, but the only part of it that is exposed above ground is actually New Zealand. And you know, there's an image, if you click on the story for this, it shows how It was a continent about two-thirds the size of Australia, but they're calling it a continent, in the Pacific Ocean. So it's fascinating to think that all these legends about a continent in the Pacific Ocean, and now here's science saying that, well, there was one that they consider a continent, albeit the smallest continent.
Yeah, it seems like, well, we talked many times about how vast and deep the oceans are and how we really, truly don't know what's down there. Or scientists don't know the whole story about what's down there. And it seems like we're always finding something new that we didn't know before.
And when I started looking into that story, I found another story about a lost continent found in the Indian Ocean under Mauritius. And I think when we did that Lemuria topic, we were saying that there was a little bit of confusion that between Mu, M-U, and Lemuria, possibly not being the same thing. Some people saying it was the same, but other people are saying one was in the Pacific and one was in the Indian Ocean. And here's another story about a discovery of another one in the Indian Ocean.
Right.
It's kind of fascinating how these stories that a lot of people just kind of don't even give any time to, thinking they're just ridiculous stories. And, you know, now they're starting to come up with proof that at least there were two continents that we weren't aware of before.
Yeah, over the years we talked about so many different mysterious topics, and I'm sure many people thought, oh, these are really off the wall, but maybe they really aren't off the wall. Maybe there is some substantial information pertaining to them.
And Chuck, you talked about how you had a real hard time believing in time travel, even though it's one of your favorite topics. I found this story about that physics reveal sensational findings which could allow science fiction dreams to become reality. And, you know, they're talking about just what we talked about before, about how there are possible multiple timelines playing out in parallel universes. And this science team, this team of physicists, believe that the parallel universes can all affect one another. So this is this whole idea of, they talk about the many worlds interpretation, where each universe branches into a bunch of new universes every time, well, they say a quantum measurement is made. What they're talking about is every time somebody makes a decision, they could have made another decision, and supposedly every one of those decisions, there's another universe created where you made the other choice, and that's playing out there. But what they're coming up with, their theory here, is that what they call many interacting worlds, which is a completely different approach, meaning that, I know a lot of the scientists, I just heard Amit Goswami recently talking about this, and how he said, well, the proof for parallel universes is just, there's just no way to prove it, so there's no reason to even look at it. And well, now these scientists are actually coming up with a theory where not only do they exist, but they can interact, which would explain a lot of things about a lot of mysterious topics we talk about. Like, for instance, ghosts. It just could be somebody kind of bleeding through a little bit from another dimension.
Yeah, doesn't this take a stretch of your imagination to believe that it's possible? But again, having an open mind allows you to do that. It seems almost impossible, but who knows?
Well, that's a great thing about not being as smart as some of these physicists, because we can at least allow for the possibility that that's what's happening, that there is some sort of parallel universe, and somehow, some way, they can every once in a while interact or bleed through slightly, and that's what we're seeing when some of these mysteries that are just cannot be explained any other way happen.
Right. And we mentioned about the time traveling and how I always enjoyed that topic. And my saying that I have a hard time having an open mind about it certainly doesn't mean I don't wish it could be possible. I think trying to work out all the details might be problematic, going back in time, and who knows what kind of implications that would have as far as changing the future and so many different things that it sounds to me like it would just be a big problem. But it sure is interesting. I've always enjoyed the time traveler type movies and books.
And I also have another link to a story about something they call time crystals and how they're proving that they're a thing. And I just don't know as much about this to really talk about it intelligently, but people can read about this phenomenon, another thing that was proposed, and now they're proving that they are real.
Yeah.
The next topic, we did a lot of space subjects in that, and this, I believe we mentioned the James Webb Space Telescope in relation to the Hubble Telescope. The Hubble Telescope is being replaced by this James Webb, and it's going to happen fairly soon in the fall of 2018 when the James Webb Space Telescope will be launched. And this is going to be, I know we talked about this, about how much further this will be able to see, and it's a completely different type of telescope. I think it's infrared. They'll be able to see much further than the Hubble has even, which is amazing to consider.
It really is. Just thinking about how far in the distance the Hubble has allowed us to see is just unbelievable. I really can't comprehend that we are able to do that. And now this James Webb telescope is going to be even much stronger or much better.
Yeah, and I have several links to it explaining it, but there is a story from spaceanswers.com. This is by Jonathan O'Callaghan from July of 2013, and it's just some facts about the James Webb Space Telescope that you might not have known. And the first one is it's as big as a tennis court, with a sun shield 22 meters or 72 feet in length, the size of a tennis court, and a mere 6.5 meters or 21 feet wide. The James Webb Space Telescope is over twice the size of the Hubble Space Telescope, making it the largest space telescope ever launched. And the mirrors are coated, it says, with a golf ball's worth of gold. The mirrors are covered in gold to optimize them for infrared light, with the gold further protected by a thin layer of glass. The thickness of the gold coating is ridiculously thin. It says there's 4.40 and 1 centimeters across the 25 square meter mirror's surface, and in total the gold weighs 48.25 grams, roughly the equivalent to the weight of a golf ball. And it's about it will be about 4 times further from the Earth than the Moon. So this is not in orbit around Earth. This is going to be way out there past the Moon.
Yeah.
It's only going to take a month to reach that position, 1.5 million kilometers or 930,000 miles from the Earth. And that is in the Lagrange point 2 or L2. So I think we talked about this before at some point. The Lagrange point is a point in space where you won't be pulled in any direction. So you can put something there and it'll stay there. It's fascinating how they're able to figure that out.
Yeah, no kidding.
But out there, it'll be unhindered by the Earth and the Moon. Although, if it malfunctions, which has happened with the Hubble, as we know, they've repaired it at least, I think, a couple times. Mm-hmm. We won't be able to fix this one. It'll be way too far out for us to get to with a person.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. It could see a penny 24 miles away. That's the the strength of this magnification. But some of the things it's going to be able to find is supposedly it could find water on exoplanets. One of the most notable abilities is that it will be able to detect planets around nearby stars by measuring infrared radiation, and it will even be able to measure the atmospheres of exoplanets by studying the starlight that passes through. By doing this, it will be able to determine if an exoplanet has liquid water on its surface. And we just had a story recently about a discovery of 7 planets orbiting a star. I forget how far. It's called the TRAPPIST
star. Yeah, the TRAPPIST-1. And it's 39 light years from Earth. And that is so far away. It's just hard to imagine something being that far away. And the fact that we are able to see it with a telescope 39 light years away, I mean, that just, it's mind-boggling. And now they believe that this TRAPPIST-1 area has a small star, which allows for perhaps temperate planets where liquid water could exist and life. And what really amazes me about this whole topic, and this was brought up by NASA just last month, they believe that this also supports the belief of many scientists that perhaps billions, John, of such worlds may exist in the Milky Way alone. Billions of such worlds that may support life in the Milky Way alone. That just tells us how insignificant we truly are. We've talked about that in the past, but yes, this just really brings it to light how if there's billions of such worlds that may support life such as ours out there just in the Milky Way, it's just mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. And to further that point, there are in that one little famous image, Hubble image of a dark part of space where there are, that's the size of a head of a pin. And when they magnified it and showed that there were thousands and thousands of galaxies in that one little pinprick of a point in sky, there are so many galaxies out there. As we said before, there's there's more galaxies than there are grains of sand on the Earth. It's just ridiculous. And as you said, just in our one little grain of sand of a galaxy, there are billions of possible planets with possible life. It's a mind blower.
It definitely is.
And one of the goals of the new telescope is to observe the first stars and galaxies that formed just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, an era of the universe that is not fully understood. This telescope will be sensitive to infrared light, which will enable it to do this, to look at the very beginning of the universe. And that's what really, Chuck, this thing is like a time travel machine. It's looking at back in time, basically.
Yeah, you're right.
And, well, of course, anyway, there's some other facts about how obviously it's going to unfold its size once it gets out to this point in space. And when it does this and when it's anchored there, it says that one side will be hotter than Death Valley and the other side will be colder than Antarctica. Obviously, the sun will be hitting it from the back and it'll be looking out. But anyway, that's, I guess you could kind of understand how that would be.
Yeah.
But here's the one thing that I'm wondering, I'm concerned about. The final fact about this is that it could keep working for a decade. The official mission lifespan for the James Webb Space Telescope is between 5 and 10 years. The telescope is limited by the amount of fuel it has on board used to maintain its position, which will be enough for a 10-year lifetime. And they say, of course, other factors like budget cuts or malfunctions could end the mission earlier, but what are they going to do after the 10 years?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they have another idea.
They have to have some other telescope ready by that time, perhaps, and send it out there.
The Hubble has been working for a long time, isn't it? Like 30 years now?
Yeah, it's been a long time. It, like you said, it has needed repairs, but it's still functioning. Now,
I would think they'd want to keep that going as well, or replace it with one similar.
Mm-hmm. It definitely has brought a lot of information to us. And even though all these advances in telescopes have shown us what the possibility of life might be in distant areas, what good does it do us other than to say, okay, they're out there? I think maybe someday we or scientists will figure out how to get to those places without having to actually fly there using conventional fuel. Maybe it'll be something like we've talked about in the past, using a wormhole, which allows us to get quickly to one distant area. Maybe it'll be something like that.
Yeah, it could be. I just hope that they're going to have something to allow us to continue doing that sort of research.
Yeah, I'm glad that they're at least spending enough money to continue that research. I think it's great.
And now for the final topic that we're going to talk about, and this is something that Chuck, you and I talked about a lot over the years. And I think it all started with when you told me about these books. I found out about them from you. One is the Celestine Prophecies, the Celestine Prophecy. And that turned into a series of books by James Redfield.
And the other one, Conversations with God.
And that also turned out to be a series of books by Neil Donald Walsh. And these are coming from the spiritual side of things. And at the time, both of us were also reading and listening to scientists such as Brian Greene and Michio Kaku, who we have talked about in the past, and how we really like their approach to explaining things. And more recently, Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I would also mention another person who was coming from a completely different approach, but I think is just as significant, just as important to read his material, and that's Nassim Haramein. Very interesting information he's putting up. But anyway, they're coming from the scientific side of it. And we talked about this, Chuck, where I felt like both of these, the spiritual side and the science side, were sometimes talking about the very same types of experiences. And if there was only a way for these two sides to be able to think in terms of the other side, they might be able to somehow come up with what's going on together.
Yeah. Before we started on this podcast, John, you and I were talking, and I was explaining some of my thoughts about spirituality and religion and how I felt uncomfortable talking publicly about someone's beliefs. Many religions have many different beliefs, obviously, and they're very special to many people. Religions of all kinds are very special. They have very special meaning to some people. And I told you about a story about a woman that I knew in my line of work that I had seen on a regular basis. She was in her 80s. And in the last several years, this person is no longer alive. But she, maybe 5 or 6 years in the last years of her life, she had become involved quite strongly in a Lutheran church. And she was finding great satisfaction in her participation in that church and in the Lutheran religion. And she was telling one of her friends about it. And this friend of hers told her son, the friend's son, about what this 80-year-old woman was experiencing with the Lutheran religion. And the son lived in a different city, and he took the time to write a typed out letter to this 80-year-old woman. And this person, that this son, was an atheist apparently, and he took it upon himself to write to this 80-year-old woman about how she shouldn't believe what she's believing and how she shouldn't take solace in the fact that this religion is offering her comfort and so forth. I mean, he went farther than just talking about many of the negative aspects of religions, which there are, which we have talked about, but there are also a lot of good aspects of religion. And this woman took it so hard that this son of her friend would write to her and disparage her positive experiences with the religion. That's why I don't feel comfortable talking about religion. Even though I may not agree with many different religions, I am certainly not in a position to disparage them in any way like this son did. And that's why I have certain feelings about even talking about religion and spiritualism publicly. I'll talk about it with you privately, but publicly it's a little different.
Yeah, and I understand that completely. I think that guy was obviously wrong to write somebody he doesn't even know about that just because he's upset that she was talking to his mother about something like that. That's just not right. And everybody, you know, as we've talked about it a lot, everybody is on their own path and they're doing things their own way. And I completely agree with that. However, I also have to say that, you know, just because a person belongs to a particular church doesn't make that theory right that you cannot even discuss about if you don't feel it. Now, you don't want to talk to a person that doesn't bring it up, but if they're going to come to you espousing their beliefs and doing the same thing to you, trying to force them upon you, I think you have a right to bring up the alternative thoughts in that area. Because like Sean and I discussed some of the history of the early times when, well, Christianity was being brought into view, you know, some of those viewpoints that were ultimately won out, it's almost like they're a Fox News version or a CNN version of some story, kind of coming at it from one point of view, and it left out another point of view entirely. And so when people talk about religion like that, I think it's allowed and proper to bring up the alternative view at that time that was known about.
And I think you made an important point to use the word or words being forced upon someone. When someone tries to force something on you or anyone, that changes the whole picture. And it even goes to the extreme where some religions, if you don't believe or go along with what they might believe in their religions, they want to eliminate you. And that takes it to the extreme. And that's where religions really get a bad name in many cases.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I hope nobody ever gets the impression that we were trying to do this at any point with any of our topics, especially the latest ones regarding that. I just felt that in view of a couple of the other topics that were all close together, that I just felt that for people that want to know about alternative thoughts at that time, they were definitely there. And a great many people aren't aware that that was the case. And also, as you said, you know, you use that word, nobody should be forced to believe in a certain thing. And I really think that, you know, a lot of people are when they're very young, sometimes very young, before they're even talking, they're being indoctrinated into that. So anyway, that's my only thoughts in that area.
Well, you definitely covered that topic with a good historian in the form of Sean Fox.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, like I said, we tried to handle it as respectfully as we could.
I think you did.
But anyway, in regards to this that we talked about, how back 20 or more years ago, I had some books by Brian Greene and Michio Kaku talking about the weird events in string theory, and then the Celestine Prophecy, if anybody doesn't know that book, and the Conversations of God, both book series have information, talking about a vibrational type situation. And I don't know, if you read that and you read some of the string theory information and other quantum mechanics type areas, I just feel that there's a lot of similarities there. They use a whole different terminology for sure, but, and that might be the problem, that they're using a whole different vernacular, so they don't understand, or they don't want to understand, because we talked about this before. Both Brian Greene and Michio Kaku are basically don't believe that there's a soul. I know Neil deGrasse Tyson feels the same way too. So it's really hard to get them to even look at some of the information in those other books because of that.
Yeah, right.
Okay, Chuck. Well, I think we're getting to the end of our show here. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, I know that the out-of-body experience topic is one that's very close to your heart. And I wanted to just mention something when you and I did the podcast about the OBEs. You made a sound that describes what you remember or recall when you were, I think, falling asleep or waking up or something, but it was like a poof sound. I can't do it like you did. But when I heard it on the podcast, it was exactly like I remembered it when I heard it, when I was falling asleep or waking up or something. And it just struck me so funny when I heard you say it on the podcast, even though I heard you when we had the discussion. I don't know how you did it, but you did it exactly the way it really sounds. Can you do that again?
I don't remember. Is that the vibrational thing, maybe? Where I went...
It was like a sound. And, yeah, I guess it is a vibration, but I can't do it.
That's the only thing I remember was doing, was okay. Explaining that.
Anyway, it was really good.
Yeah, just like that. Or,
yeah, that's pretty
okay,
good.
Maybe that's it. But that's it. It's almost like when you put your finger in a socket, you know, or you get a quick little electrical shock kind of thing. It's that kind of, yeah.
Yeah. I would go just a little bit more on the OBEs. I was thinking about when you're experiencing that, you really don't feel or touch or have any, like you couldn't hug somebody, could you? When you're out of your body, and hugs are important to people, that connection with other people. And
so it's really complicated, but the way I understand it from what William was talking about, that sometimes when you have these, you're talking about the experience where you have an OBE, but you're in the same room that your body is, and then you're able to move about the house. And some people even say that they don't even realize they're out of their body until they, you know, they're thirsty. They go down the stairs, they open the refrigerator, but they can't open it because their hand is going right through it. And that's when they realize that sort of thing. Whereas with, I think, anyone, not necessarily just somebody that gets proficient at it, but if you happen to go to another dimension, such as William writes about in some of his books, going to the astral plane where he visited his uncle and his mother and had a physical, was able to physically hug them. And it was as real, if not more real, than here. In that place, they still have their physical bodies. And yes, you're able to hug and embrace and do everything here and more.
Well, that's good, because I just have a hard time imagining not being able to hug somebody. What about eating? I like to eat.
Yeah, you know, I can't remember. I don't think you have to on the astral plane. I think there is some things there that you can, but I don't think you have to.
But I enjoy it.
I don't know, but that information is in Adventures in the Afterlife, which was written as a fictional story with a fictional character, but it all has to do with William's experience while he was going through his cancer treatment. Just explaining how that astral realm is, and it's all really fascinating.
Well, I won't go into it any further. It's obviously a vast topic, and one that you are very well versed in, but those are just a couple of
thoughts. Yeah, well, it sounds like you're getting more interested in it as well, so hopefully I can involve you in some of that research.
I still don't want to do it.
Well, we'll see. We'll have time to change your mind.
All right.
Okay, well, in closing, just want to give a sincere thank you to you, the listener. You made this a special experience for us that we will never forget. Thank you to all who have used our Amazon link and to everyone sending a PayPal donation as well to help defray the costs involved with the podcast over the years and the website. But most importantly, we cherish the relationships developed through email and Facebook with many of you. Whether it was just once or ongoing, we discovered our interaction with our listeners to be the most rewarding part of this journey. A few people told us that listening to Mysterious Topics helped them get through some rough times, which really warms our hearts.
It certainly does.
Our intention from the beginning was to give people that may not have anyone to have an open-minded conversation about Mysterious Topics a couple of friends to do just that with. And we appreciate everyone taking the time to correspond with us, confirming we achieved that goal. And I just also want to say that I do plan to keep the website active for at least some time, at least through the year, and probably past that. I hope to keep hearing from listeners who have questions or opinions about any episodes or anything else for that matter. For anyone wishing to know any new news regarding us, please like our Mysterious Topics Facebook page, which we will keep running as well. And I will post any updates there and maybe an occasional Mysterious Topic post every now and then. And you can also message us there as well. And I just also want to say that I'm trying to figure this out. I don't know. I don't really know much about it yet, but I know there is a Facebook Live option. And, you know, I may even do that from time to time. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Chuck and I, if we have something to discuss, we could do that. Or with Sean. Sean, there's a lot of other history areas that might be a possibility. So that could possibly happen there at some point. And that would be one of those things where it wouldn't require the extensive work that a podcast does right now. So we might be able to just have a conversation about a topic, and then as soon as we're done, people could listen to it live, or I think it gets posted there so that you can listen to it at a later time as well. But again, I don't really know that much about it yet, but I am looking into it, and that might be a possible way for us to still have a conversation every now and then without the immense work involved.
I totally agree with everything you just said.
So this is the end of our journey. I would like to close with a quote, and since we are very close to St. Patrick's Day when we're recording this, St. Patrick's Day will be just in 2 days, and you will be hearing this until March 26th, but I just felt that this was appropriate at this time. And it is, goodbyes are not forever, goodbyes are not the end. They simply mean I'll miss you until we meet again.
Amen.
All right, Chuck. Well, so this is it. Thank you all for listening over the years.
Yes, and this is Chuck. Thank you all. We really appreciate your friendship. And goodbye.
This is John. Until we meet again.